Hey, this weekend has some good news. 215,000 jobs were added to the U.S. economy last month. And even better, the proportion of people in the labor force went up to 63%. Might not sound like much, but that's the most in 2 years. And yes, the unemployment rate went up a tad to 5%. But, and this is important, that's because more people joined the workforce. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. Okay, so that's the good news. The bad news is there are still a lot of booms and busts in our economy, and we're going to hear about them this week in all sorts of microeconomies, like oil or markets for different kinds of food, and in places like Puerto Rico, where the government's debt crisis is hurting people's everyday lives. Come join our conversation at marketplace.org, on our Facebook page, or on Twitter. We're at Marketplace WKND. We are starting off the show with a segment that digs into the boom and bust phenomenon a little bit. It's called Long and Short, and that's when we appropriate jargon from the world of business for our own purposes. Long as in betting on something, like a stock. Short as in betting against it. We do it with news stories and current events. And this week we have Marketplace's Kimberly Adams and Danielle Belton, an associate editor at The Root. Welcome to you both.
Hi, hey. Lizzie.
You're in the same studio. I feel sort of far away and sad not to be with you guys. But Danielle, I'm going to let you start. What are you long?
I am long on this amazing 11-year-old entrepreneur that I discovered this week. I like I discovered her as if the world didn't already know about her. Because last year she was on Shark Tank and she won $60,000 for her lemonade that she made. And like a lot of kids start lemonade stands in the summertime. But this 11-year-old started Sweet Bee Lemonade. Her name is Michaela Ulmer. And she just got a deal where she's going to sell her lemonade in 55 Whole Foods stores in Texas, Arkansas, Oklahoma, and Louisiana. And she has a chance that if this does well, it could go nationwide.
That's amazing. And then you wrote us notes about this. You said that some of the proceeds go to help,
to saving bees,
support bee populations. Yeah.
Yes. Is it, because there's been all these issues with bees dying, and so that's part of the reason why she used honey to sweeten the lemonade, because she wanted to kind of bring awareness around this issue.
Wow.
So she's like the most thoughtful 11-year-old ever.
Take that,
I was definitely
claps.
Not that. Yes. I was not that cool at 11, or maybe ever. Kimberly, what are you long?
So mine is not nearly as nice and fun and positive. I'm going to go long on Zika because I think the Zika virus is going to be with us for a while. It's popping up quite a bit in Puerto Rico. Obviously, Brazil has so many cases. It's spreading throughout Central America. Here in Washington, the Washington, D.C. area this week, the National Institutes of Health had a summit with all of these rival scientists trying to brainstorm ideas for what to do about it. It's something that we're all going to have to be aware of as we go into the summer months. And so longer sleeves than maybe we wanted and lots of insect repellent. So I guess I should also go long on the mosquito repellent companies.
Yeah, definitely. I am also interested in, we have looked at, and others in the media have looked at, the mosquito-borne cases of Zika, which is obviously, we're talking about the majority of transmission there. But then there's also a sexually transmitted component, which is responsible for some of the cases in the U.S. And I feel like, despite guidelines from the Centers for Disease Control, a lot of people don't know about that part of it.
A lot of people don't. And it's interesting, as best I can tell from what I've been seeing about it, it's only transmitted sexually from men to women, which seems to be quite different. There was a poll out by Harvard University earlier this week as well, where they just sort of tested how much people actually know about the Zika virus, and it wasn't that much. Didn't know it was sexually transmitted, thought there was a vaccine for it, there isn't, and generally just had no idea that it was going to be in the United States probably this summer.
I'm already naturally paranoid. I don't know how many more things can I be afraid of. This is just getting ridiculous.
Oh, I could give you such a long list. Such a long list.
I gotta add this now.
Yeah, probably. Certainly as we head into summer. Then I'm gonna let you maybe take us back, I don't know, to happy stuff or not. What do you want to short?
I was going to talk about the presidential debates and town halls because I'm sick of them. But I'm actually, I'm not going to talk about that. I'm going to let that go. And instead, I'm short on the TV show Empire. Empire's coming back this week on Fox to finish out its second season. This season has not been as memorable as the first. I mean, it's had like a lot of really outre kind of like bizarre moments, like when Cookie put on a gorilla suit in the season opener.
Yeah, that was pretty
weird. Sale, their like weird Black Lives Matter moment, like that was where it's about mass incarceration, but it's about a character who actually killed somebody and probably deserves to be in prison. So it was a lot of like, it was just weird. So it's like the ratings really took a hit. Like it went from a 6.7 with the season opener and it dropped down to 4.5 by the time the midseason finale rolled around. I mean, it's basically in a sophomore slump. Not as many people care about it anymore, but I feel like it'll just limp on forever because it was such a big hit initially and 4.5 isn't that bad of a number. So I feel like it'll be kind of like how it was with Glee where, you know, no matter how bad it got, Fox just kept renewing it. And I feel like they will keep renewing this show, trying to recapture the magic.
Are you short enough that you're going to stop watching, though?
You know, I invest in TV shows. Like, it takes a lot for me to, like, no matter how bad it gets, like, it's got to get pretty bad for me, like, to get off the wagon. So I'm going to watch just to see how terrible it gets. I want to see how low this is going to go. Like, I don't know how you, like, top the gorilla suit, but, it's Lee Daniels. It could go anywhere.
I wish all I could right. comment. I've never actually seen the show. I know.
Sadly. Really? Oh, come on. What are you short, Kimberly?
So I'm going to be a bit more boring, and I am going to go short on some types of financial advisors. Okay, so there's basically two kinds of financial advisors you can have, and I'm going short on the commission-based financial advisors. That's because the Department of Labor is putting out a new rule, probably in early April, that's going to say that you cannot make more money if you sell your clients a particular kind of product, because consumer advocates and the Department of Labor says that some financial advisors are pushing their clients into products that aren't really good for their retirement because they make higher commissions off of it. And so right now they are allowed to do that because their advice is free and they just make their commissions. But the Department of Labor says that's a conflict of interest. We don't want that happening anymore.
Kimberly Adams from Marketplace, Danielle Belton from The Root. Thank you both very much.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Thank you.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. Now to a deepening series of busts, you could say. Brazil seems to be lurching from one crisis to another. The PMDB, the largest political party in the country, left the governing coalition this week, putting the presidency of Dilma Rousseff in even more jeopardy. Brazil is deep in recession. The opposition wants her impeached, and several people in her party have been tied to the corruption scandal with the oil giant Petrobras. Rousseff's predecessor, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, told reporters on Monday that an impeachment would amount to a coup. He is also being investigated over accepting gifts from construction companies linked to Petrobras. From our partners at the BBC, Wire Davies reports on the chaos in Brazil.
Estabilidade democrática do país.
Brazil's embattled president, Dilma Rousseff, is in a bare-knuckle fight for her political life.
Eu jamais renunciarei.
I'm not resigning. There will not be a coup, she declared defiantly this week, as a widening corruption scandal threatened to derail her government. This is an increasingly polarized country. There were pro-government demonstrations last week in cities from São Paulo to Salvador. But they followed even bigger protests a few days earlier, calling for the impeachment of President Rousseff. This vehement anti-government sentiment comes barely a decade after Brazil was the darling of the developing world, its economy booming and progressive social policies helping to elevate millions out of poverty. But a huge anti-corruption probe, known as the car wash investigation, has implicated several senior politicians and top business leaders. Deltan Dallagnol, one of the lead prosecutors based in the southern city of Curitiba, gave me an indication of the scale of their investigation.
Corruption is very harmful to Brazil. We have corruption that amounts up to $40 billion per year. This represents three times the amount of money which is invested in the health system or in the educational system.
And what is, I suppose, unique about this case is that it involves so many people from big companies, from government. That doesn't put you off, does it?
For the first time in our history, we were able to prosecute at the same time high-level politicians and high-level business people with strong evidence that they were corrupted in amounts which go up to billions of dollars.
Much recent attention has focused on former President Lula da Silva. Dilma Rousseff's charismatic predecessor has been accused of directly benefiting from millions of dollars in kickbacks from some of Brazil's biggest construction firms. Lula angrily denies the charges, saying the prosecutors are conducting a politicized crusade against the left-wing Workers' Party government. João Ferrez, a political analyst from the State University of Rio de Janeiro, says the corruption probe is important, but
the main flaws, I think, are, you know, related to the excessive autonomy of the judiciary branch and also of Ministério Público, which is like a general prosecutor. So when you have people that are in these powers, in these branches of government that have a political intent, you know, things can go bad as they're going now.
By releasing transcripts of phone conversations between ex-President Lula and Dilma Rousseff, many Brazilians here on the street say the judge in charge of the case overstepped the mark. But says constitutional lawyer Ana Paula de Barcelos, as disruptive as it might be now, the investigation will be good for Brazil in the long run.
It seems like a mess, and it is. But I think that what we'll get after that is positive, and I think we'll have a stronger Brazil and stronger institutions and less corruption. I would expect that in 10 years from now.
The impeachment process in Congress against President Rousseff may gather pace, or she may succeed in fighting her way out of it. But perhaps the biggest threat to Brazil's future is if the anti-corruption investigations are watered down or even suspended. In such an eventuality, the only winners will be the same political and business elites who've ruled this country for decades.
That's the BBC's Wire Davies. There's a reason why we do the numbers on Marketplace. Behind every number in the business world is often a great story. On our website, marketplace.org, our By the Numbers blog finds the most interesting numbers in the news. Here's Marketplace's Tony Wagner and Dan Semitovich with this week's news, By the Numbers. Tony?
Thanks, Lizzie. Our first number is
100 million.
That's many dollars in tax credits low-income Philadelphians are leaving on the table.
We're specifically talking about the earned income tax credit here. A fifth of the eligible people in Philly didn't claim it last year.
It's designed to combat poverty, so the city is trying to figure out why so many people don't know about it.
1.4 million.
That's how many men, aged 25 to 54, have left the workforce since the recession began.
Most of these men cite illness, disability, going back to school, and responsibilities at home.
But some economists theorize that the reasons are more complicated. They say these men could find work, but they're discouraged and avoiding lower paying or less prestigious jobs.
Up to 1,000.
That's many dollars the city of Richmond, California is paying a convict every month.
The condition? A pledge to not commit another gun crime.
It's a controversial and unconventional approach, but it seems to be working.
Miami, Baltimore, Toledo, and Washington, D.C. are all looking into it, too.
We're going to talk about your own microeconomies now. Last week on the show, we asked you to confess and tell us about the lies you tell to save money. Everything from your kid, who is definitely not under 12 at a theme park, to the more serious tales you might be telling on your tax refund. Some of these lies were, well, literally dirty, like this one from Nick Wagner in Albuquerque about washing his dog.
The lie that I've told is about the weight of my 115-pound bloodhound. His name's Duke. He's big and red, looks just like the bloodhound from the Beverly Hillbillies. He slobbers, he bays, he's very loud. And he costs me $15 to bathe once a month. But that's the reduced fee that I lie about. or if I told them the actual weight at the self-serve dog wash, they would charge me $25.
Wait, they would charge you $25 to wash your own dog?
Yes, it's you wash your own dog, you bring him there, they let you use their equipment, but they charge you based on the weight of your animal.
How long have you been doing this, and how much money do you think you've saved overall?
I save like $10 a wash, and so we bathe him once a month. He's 5 or 6 years old now, so, I don't know, a couple $100.
Yeah. Do you feel guilty?
I feel guilty now only talking and somewhat bragging about it. So now is really the only guilt I've ever felt. It's just such a headache that I feel like I shouldn't have to pay $10 more to deal with this. Plus, I'm washing my own dog. No one's washing him for me. So I've rationalized it that way.
A lot of you seem to be lying about your age to save a few bucks, specifically cashing in on old student IDs. Lucas Miller in St. Paul tweeted at us about how he's still using his student ID 6 years after graduation.
My ID doesn't have an expiration date, and I'm able to just kind of flash that and get, you know, an upgrade for, you know, soda or a discount on movie tickets. And the biggest ticket item that I shared via Twitter was when I was in Vegas, I got a discount for seeing The Lion King off-Broadway. I saved $100 on that ticket alone.
Wow. How much do you think you've saved overall by doing this?
Probably overall, since I've graduated in 2010, probably about $500, maybe $600. Definitely by far the Las Vegas trip was the biggest ticket item that I've saved. It's mostly, you know, in the range of $5 or maybe $10 savings on average.
I have to ask you, what do you think of the ethics of this?
I could say that it's, you know, probably not the most ethical thing. However, I'm paying back my student loans. I try to go as legit as I can, but hey, I mean, a free pop's a free pop, right?
Yeah, true. And, you know, you mentioned student debt. It's not like being a student is exactly a free enterprise either.
No, it's not. And I'm still paying that off and will continue to pay that off in the coming years. So if I can get some benefits from my student ID as I move forward, you know, that helps.
On Twitter, we heard from more people lying about little things.
I almost always ask for a water cup and get lemonade at Chipotle.
And from even more people milking their outdated student status.
I use my student ID for free or discounted movies, as well as general pity around town.
And from online gamers doing their e-shopping in another state.
I tell Nintendo I live in New Hampshire, so e-shop purchases are tax-free. This is going to earn me an audit, isn't it?
I hope not. Thanks to everyone who wrote or left us a voicemail. Next week, we want to know what you waste and how much you think it costs you. Let us know by going to Marketplace.org, Marketplace's Facebook page, or call us at 1-800-648-5114. Consumer demand is driving a lot of changes in the world of food nowadays, creating new markets. Many consumers are willing to pay a premium for foods labeled organic, free-range, natural, etc. But those definitions can be pretty confusing. Earlier this year, for example, the U.S. Department of Agriculture ruled that it no longer has the authority to define what the phrase grass-fed beef actually means, even though you'll still see that label at the grocery store. You might be thinking to yourself that it can't be that hard to figure out if a cow ate grass for dinner. But as Julia Calderon writes for Tech Insider, it's a lot more complicated. We brought her on to explain. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I have to admit that I recently went grocery shopping and I bought a package of beef to make beef bourguignon that said grass-fed beef on it. And I bought it because it said grass-fed beef. Am I a sucker?
I wouldn't say that you're a sucker. I would say that you've probably been duped by some of the marketing claims that some big meat companies make. And you probably don't even realize it, but you were tricked by their advertising.
When I think of grass-fed, I guess wrongly after reading your piece thought, okay, well, this cow has been kind of wandering around outside eating grass its entire life. What does grass-fed mean?
Yeah, so that's the complicated question. It turns out that right now there isn't really a definition of what grass-fed means. So in January, the U.S. government decided that they're no longer going to have an official definition of what grass-fed means. It's now up to the companies to define it. And they can go to the government and they can say, hey, this is the standard that we hold our cattle to. The government then says, okay, we believe you, without now having to go visit their farms, do audits. They basically are just looking at their paperwork and saying, okay, we're going to take you at your word.
Wow. So there's no kind of, all right, we're going to send a neutral arbiter out there and take a look at your facilities or anything like that?
Yeah. So there are third-party inspections and auditors that will do that, but the company has to pay them to do that in addition to the government. So they're not required to go through that route, but they can. Now that the government has actually dropped the definition, it's not holding them to any standard. So before, at least, there was a standard, and now there is nothing.
Grass-fed beef, anything with that label, tends to be a good bit more expensive. What's the margin like there?
Yeah, so according to a Consumer Reports report, they found that grass-fed beef is usually about $2.50 to $3 more per pound.
Wow, that adds up.
So it's pretty substantial.
This feels to me a bit like it echoes some of the questions around what makes something organic or what makes something non-genetically modified, because consumer preferences are changing and we want these things, but it's hard to know who to trust.
That's exactly right. And I think there's a movement now that some companies are urging the government to stop regulating these terms because they are ambiguous and people don't really know what they mean, and even the government doesn't really know what they mean. So terms like natural, the government doesn't really specifically define what natural means. It's confusing for everyone, and actually both the consumers and the producers lose out, because especially with the grass-fed claim, if a producer isn't convincing their customers that it's 100% grass-fed, then they're not going to trust it and they're not going to buy it and spend more money on it.
One of the details that stuck out to me in your story is, I think someone's saying to you, well, all cows eat grass at some point in their life cycle, so I guess you could say they're all grass-fed.
Exactly, and that's how some of these producers sort of slip through those little loopholes, because they can say, my cow was fed grass for 80 or 90% of its life, and then to make more money in the end, they'll just feed it grain to fatten it up and basically make more money off of it.
So if you're a consumer, what do you do?
So that's one of the complicated questions, and there's not one answer to this. By far, the best thing a consumer can do is to know exactly where their meat comes from. And so this means shopping local, going to their farmers markets, going to, you know, farmers they trust. Ideally, they'd inspect the farms themselves, and, you know, but most people don't have the time to do that. So if you can't do that, if you don't have a local farmers market or a farmer that you know, the next best thing is to look for a third-party certification program, something that aligns with what you think grass-fed is. So basically, the animal was not kept in confinement, the animal was not fed anything other than grass, and also not fed hormones or antibiotics. Third-party certification programs like American Grass-Fed Association, the Food Alliance, they run trusted third-party programs.
Do you see any of this likely to change?
So recently, a lot of organizations have been writing open letters to the government saying that you should basically put the definition back. You need to reinstate the definition. I think that the government is probably realizing that they made a mistake by dropping the definition, and they probably will consider reinstating it. It's really too soon to know what's going to happen, but hopefully there'll be something in place so people can know what they're buying.
Julia Calderon, a science reporter for Tech Insider, thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Lizzie.
There is a fascinating microeconomy in the world of tattoos. If it seems like you notice more and more of them lately, there's a reason. The tattoo industry is growing. About a third of U.S. adults had at least one tattoo last year, according to a Harris poll. And the market research firm Ibis World says tattoos will be a $1 billion industry by 2020. All that means tattoo artists are trying new ways to lure customers. Levi Sharp got some ink for journalism for this story.
You've probably heard of designer flash sales for clothes, but what about for this? That's the sound of me getting a rabbit skull tattooed on the back of my left arm by the popular Rachel Hauer. She works out of East River Tattoo in Greenpoint, Brooklyn. The shop is covered in art. Taxidermy foxes guard the door. Hauer is typically booked many months in advance, but I was able to get in by going to one of her famous first-come, first-serve tattoo flash days. Hauer explains flash days like this.
So basically on these days, you can only get pre-drawn designs, aka flash, and you get them all day.
She drew up her designs the night before, posting the results, known as a flash sheet, on Instagram. She has over 52,000 followers. Being Easter Sunday, the sheet was full of whimsical bunnies and chicks. Long before the event even starts, there's a line of people snaking out the door to the end of the block, hoping to get in. Rachel Lee from Queens and her friend got there 6 hours early to be first.
It's because we've been to other flash events where we've been beaten by other people, and when we arrived at like 9 or 10. So, I mean, we were at the fast flash event we went together. There was a group of three who got here at like 5 in the morning from Connecticut or something like that.
Rachel Hauer.
It's super weird because I've never been a cool person in high school, usually, you know. Doing Star Trek tattoos, it's not necessarily like on the cheerleading squad.
Another of Hauer's popular flash days happens every Halloween, where she offers Star Trek-themed tattoos. Her hourly rate is $300, but on that day, tattoos are just $100. She calls it Trek or Treat, and it's a good example of not only how discounted her tattoos can be, but also the volume she does.
Last year, I think I did close to 13 of them, which was really super spectacular and a lot of fun because I think it's just a really fun situation. Everyone can kind of giggle about it because Halloween, Star Trek, it was a late night delirium where I was like, Trek or treat, that's it.
Engage.
So tattoo specials came about in the 1990s.
That's Anna Felicity Friedman, an author and tattoo historian. She says that a Dallas tattoo artist named Oliver Peck
comes up with the idea to do $13 tattoos on Friday the 13th, and he and his shop create this historic flash sheet of all different permutations of the number 13 and other bad luck signs, and this idea really catches on.
Not only does the idea of Friday the 13th flash days catch on, but an uptick in other tattoo specials as well. Friedman says this is due in part to tattooing becoming an increasingly competitive industry. And when you're looking at that competition, you have to think about the tattoo industry in two different tiers, street shops and elite shops. As Friedman puts it,
a street shop would be In-N-Out Burgers, and an elite shop would be having a custom chef that cooks in your own home.
Well, those super cheap street shop flash specials might just appeal to someone's spontaneity and thriftiness. More expensive ones at elite shops inspire the collector's spirit.
People have the capacity to collect small versions of artworks by their favorite tattooers in the same way that a consumer of fancy sneakers or fancy handbags is able to go around and collect different examples from different brands that are well known for being incredible examples of this type of accessory.
This was true for many of the people I spoke to waiting in line for Hauer. The fact that her designs were Easter-themed didn't factor into their decisions to get a tattoo. Take Maureen Flack, an interior design student at Pratt Institute.
I think like everybody else, I love Rachel Hauer a lot. And anything that she could have done, I probably would have showed up.
But even on a good flash day, Friedman says street shops don't make much more money. And as for elite shops,
we don't see the flash sales days as much of a financial opportunity.
Kitty Jo St. Marie is the project manager at East River Tattoo.
There is more staffing. You are going through a whole lot more supplies.
Even if a tattoo artist like Hauer does a flash day where she tattoos 15 designs at $160 a piece, which is what the Easter flash day was priced, 8 hours of tattooing on a regular day would make her about the same amount. So if these flash days are more hectic, guzzle up supplies, and aren't much of a moneymaker, why does she do it?
So much of tattoo is like commission-based, so this really gives you a chance to maybe do some pieces that you've had on your back burner that you really wanted to do but haven't had the opportunity to do. I do get a decent amount of first-timers on the flash days, so it can be a really great push for people to get their first tattoo to just see, throw it into the wind and see what happens.
On the other side of Brooklyn, at Leatherneck's Tattoo in Park Slope, I sat outside and spoke to Landon Morgan. He has a big, bushy beard. His shaved head is decorated with a serpent coiling around five swords. He used flash days to kickstart his career. But he says that tattooers, just like any other artist, have to watch out that they don't devalue their work with too many flash days. And he doesn't like to do them anymore.
If you don't care about your time, then nobody else will. So it's kind of, you have to be careful about the way you price tattoos and how often you give away reasonably lower to cheap tattoos.
Now, he mostly does flash days purely for charity, like
the Long Island Bulldog Rescue. I designed a flash sheet that had like little bulldogs and stuff because I love bulldogs, and I wanted to do something I wanted to do. To think that I was able to feed a few dogs, I was like, oh, cool.
Back at East River, my tattoo is done.
All right, sir, I'm going to clean you off. You have one completed bunny skull.
I asked myself, would I have gotten a rabbit skull on my arm if it weren't for a flash day? Probably not. But it didn't break the bank. And it was worth it to get an amazing design from a prominent tattoo artist. I'm Levi Sharp for Marketplace.
Puerto Rico is in the middle of a debt crisis. The island owes more than $72 billion, with a payment of $422 million due to its creditors the 1st of May. Unlike a state, Puerto Rico is not protected by Chapter 9 and can't file for bankruptcy. So the future of the island and its debt is very unclear. Marketplace's Andy Euler has been reporting on the debt crisis for months and just returned from a week on the island to see how it's affecting people's lives. Hey, Andy, tell me a little bit more about your trip and the people you met.
I was trying to get a sense of essentially where they were being affected by their government's debt. And so people that I talked to said they were worried about their pensions. They said that they didn't think that they could start a business there in Puerto Rico. No money, no capital was coming into Puerto Rico because nobody was buying bonds because they're essentially defaulting. I have kind of an interesting example. I met up with a woman named Marita Tessonier. She's from Ponce, and she has a PhD in international economics. She has an MBA, and she's done a lot of stuff. Now she makes candles at her house. So they let me into their house and showed me kind of what they were doing. It's a small business. But then she told me about the costs of the stuff that she was doing, of making these candles. It's something that you and I probably wouldn't have to think about.
The shipping is the double of the material. Always is the double and more of the material that I have to use to make these candles, double of the cost of the paraffin.
So she's saying that the shipping is essentially double the cost of her material. What created that?
You're right. It's actually a law written here in Washington that goes back about 100 years, called the Jones Act. It says any goods carried by water between U.S. ports have to be on U.S. ships that are constructed in the U.S., owned by U.S. citizens. In other words, basically everything that enters or leaves Puerto Rico has to be on a U.S. ship to and from U.S. ports. That's every consumer item that passes between the U.S. and Puerto Rico has to be on a ship. Now, we're talking about cars from Japan, anything from South America, any product from anywhere. And in order to comply with the Jones Act, you have to offload this merchandise. So you have to offload all of these cars from the original carrier and reload it onto a U.S. ship and then deliver that to Puerto Rico. So you can imagine shipping ports in Jacksonville are, you know, into this. They also repealed a law or tax code about 10 years ago. It was a 10-year phase out of 936. And if you talk to any Puerto Rican, they know what 936 is. That gave mainland companies an exemption from federal tax on income earned in Puerto Rico. And so companies would start, they would put subsidiaries in Puerto Rico, or they would just have branches there because they knew that they weren't being taxed on any income there. So this was spreading a lot of money throughout the island in terms of pharmaceuticals and manufacturing and things like that. And you can kind of trace the decline of the Puerto Rican economy back about 10 years when 936 was finally out.
How is all of this playing out politically and on the mainland? And does this impact the presidential election at all?
I think every candidate knows Puerto Rican votes are really important. And, you know, there are talks of sovereignty because Puerto Ricans are U.S. citizens, but Puerto Rico is not a state. There's all sorts of kind of complicated stuff that goes into this. So they're talking about it, and each presidential candidate will probably visit the island. But it's not Puerto Ricans on the island that they're worried about. What the candidates are looking for are votes from Puerto Ricans on the mainland. They hold primaries, but they don't actually vote for president. And so you're looking for votes in places like Florida and New York with large Puerto Rican populations. They're hoping that a visit to the island will maybe send them votes. You know, family members might call them and say, hey, you know, Hillary Clinton visited the island. You should probably vote for her. But my sense after spending a week there is that Puerto Ricans on the island don't really feel like politicians on the mainland really care that much about what's going on.
Marketplace's Andy Euler, thank you very much.
No, thank you.
Now, from one financial bust to another. For several years, workers, often men, were flocking to North Dakota to work in the oil and gas industry during the shale boom. Now, oil prices have fallen. The state's unemployment rate is still very low, 2.9%, but many workers are moving on and leaving behind so-called man camps or temporary housing. Listener Corey Moore in Texas wrote to us on Facebook asking about what's happening to the camps and the cities where they're located. As part of our segment called Local Money, where we dig into your questions, we got Bill Carraher to explain. He studies the camps for the North Dakota Man Camp Project, and he's also a professor at the University of North Dakota. Welcome to the show.
Thanks.
For people who don't know, can you explain what a man camp is?
A man camp's one of any number of different things, actually. The thing that we most commonly associate with the term man camp, these things are these kind of large prefabricated kind of warrens of interconnected buildings that are brought out to remote locations where workforces are needed to deal with usually a particular short-term operation, a short-term challenge. Anything from extractive industries like we have out here in the Bakken in western North Dakota to, you know, the Olympic Village or something like that, where you're going to have a bunch of people living for a short period of time. And there's an industry, the logistics industry, that sort of supports this sort of short-term housing needs.
So what happens to these abandoned camps that are there now?
It's pretty interesting, actually. Some of them, I mean, any number of things. Some of them are just quite boring, right? They put up big fences. They say, don't go in. And they're let to sit pending some sort of resolution. Some of these, because there's a bond involved, will be disassembled. And, you know, we all hope that some kind of reclamation takes place. So their sightings are returned to some, you know, quote, pristine shape or whatever the deal they had worked out with the communities are. Others are truly abandoned. Some seem to be reoccupied by squatters. There have been a number of places where we've gone that the doors are kind of slightly ajar. And when you sort of peer in, you know, knock on the door and sort of peer in, you think, this door is not open because the last guy forgot to close it behind him. This door is open because someone's living there who doesn't have a key. So I think there's a range of sort of behaviors to the big companies like Target Logistics, who seem to be content to wait out this dip, recognizing that if oil prices go up, there may be a rapid increase in the need for workforce in the Bakken again. After all, the drill rigs are sitting in a meadow outside of Dickinson. The oil companies haven't shipped those to the next hot spot.
We saw that Williston is, expected to ban these camps entirely? What's going on there?
I think this is a really interesting thing. So what's happened in a number of the communities in western North Dakota is they've built permanent housing. The hope, and this dates back to the 1950s and the earlier oil booms, is to capture some of the people who come into this region to work in the oil industry and move them into the community to sort of fortify population, to level, to provide new blood, to provide new ideas, to expand the economies of these relatively slow-growing, in many cases declining, towns. The trick is, how do you capture those people if short-term housing options remain available? So shutting down some of these workforce housing sites is either a way to push people to live in permanent housing and also to kind of bolster occupancy of hotel rooms. So there's a kind of social engineering that's going on in the background here, as much as there is a sort of economic response. In other words, if we can somehow get out in the Bakken, there's been this kind of persistent narrative. The national media has reinforced it that, you know, a bunch of guys working out in the Bakken, you know, on their own without their families sort of go feral, right? That this is not a good situation. So, you know, there is a kind of social engineering element here. Let's get these workforce housing sites where single men live in the company of other single men. I'm sitting on a college campus right now. I'm a university professor, and we all know that no good comes of that situation. And I'm sort of kidding, but moving them into then single family homes, and this, you know, reinforces a kind of notion of what domestic life should be in a small town on the prairie. So,
The folks in Williston, to some degree, are buying into the idea that the feral worker man is not something that they want, and they would prefer to have, I guess, what, people with roots?
Yeah, I think that's a lot of it. They want to have this kind of image of you know, the small town or the suburbs where you have single family homes or, you know, even multifamily homes, but they're oriented toward families coming into the region. Now, whether this jives with the needs of the oil industry, particularly in our 21st century fast paced world where, you know, these companies can come and go at a moment's notice, I think is the open question, right? So the abandonment of workforce housing or the struggle for workforce housing to remain relevant in these communities is really, as much as anything, a response to the needs of extractive industries, which says, we want to be able to ramp up quick. We want to be able to ramp down quickly, because that's the way capital and oil prices and global markets kind of work in the 21st century.
Well, you know, we are talking to you in part because of the current drop in oil prices and the follow-on effects of that. But you're a history professor, and in your work studying these, you have written that this is not a 21st century phenomenon, that this is sort of part of the history of the oil and gas industry.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in some ways, extractive industries have been ahead of the curve, simply because short-term settlement from mining camps of the 19th century through to what we see in the Bakken today has been part and parcel of how this industry has responded to the vagaries of markets. In the 21st century, though, maybe we're seeing more and more businesses sort of adopting this kind of approach, right? From dormitory labor in China to bringing people on site to do construction projects and things like that. So maybe extractive industries sort of presaged the 21st century pace of capital.
Bill Carraher, Associate Professor of History at the University of North Dakota, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Have a story or idea for our Local Money Project? Tell us on Facebook or go to our website, marketplace.org, and click on Local Money to share it. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. If you've ever gone to your favorite YouTube channel and thought, you know, I'd watch this for an hour and a half, you're in luck. Because this weekend, the movie Natural Born Pranksters is out in theaters, and it stars three of YouTube's biggest stars. As strange as that sentence might have actually sounded a few years ago. Not anymore. Marketplace's entertainment correspondent Adrian Hill is here to tell us about why YouTube stars are crossing over to the big screen. Hi, Adrian.
Hey, Lizzie.
So what is the deal here? Is this just like a 90-minute long YouTube video?
I haven't seen the movie, so I'm not sure. Okay. It's called Natural Born Pranksters. It's out this weekend. It stars these three YouTube celebrities who are known for being pranksters. And it looks like, based on the trailer, this is just like three guys given a huge budget to pull whatever outrageous pranks they want. So
why?
I don't know. I don't know if there's a plot there beyond that.
Why does Lionsgate, they're the company behind this, why do they think that three YouTube stars can fill a theater?
Right. I mean, so many of these YouTube channels and stars reach huge audiences, some bigger than those of TV shows or even movies. I mean, the three stars of Natural Born Pranksters have a combined audience of 25 million YouTube subscribers.
Wow.
The trailer to the movie I was watching today, it's been viewed nearly 2 million times. And it's not just Lionsgate trying to capitalize on the built-in audience of these YouTube stars. I mean, one of my favorite shows on TV, Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, mm-hmm. stars Rachel Bloom, girl crush, who started on YouTube. Freddie Wong has a show now on Hulu. Miranda Sings is going to have a Netflix show. There's a Viner named King Bach. He's landed regular roles on television. But so it's happening that more and more of these YouTube stars are getting plucked out or choosing to go to more traditional media outlets.
I love Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. I'm a big fan of the musical numbers, as you know. But, I mean, this is sort of a risky proposition. It's not like success is guaranteed.
Absolutely not at all. This is all still a work in progress for both the media companies and for the YouTube stars themselves. I mean, I don't know if you ever heard of Grace Helbig. She had a show
on... Sure, she talked to Kai, yeah.
Yes, she had a show on E! And it just wasn't able to attract her online fans to that show. I spoke with a professor at USC named Jitender Sadev, and he explained why this is so tricky, especially for these YouTube stars trying to move over to traditional media.
You know, when YouTube stars are doing their own thing on YouTube, they come across as being a lot more authentic and they connect a lot more with audiences because everything is aligned. It's all coming from one place and it's coming from a place of conviction and sincerity.
So, I mean, I understand that if you look at, say, Rachel Bloom's videos on YouTube, they are, shall we say, nowhere near as safe as some of the numbers that are featured on Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, which are pretty out there for
television.
For television,
yeah.
But again, they're not quite YouTube. So, I mean, it sounds like he's saying people can lose their authenticity when they do this, and that's the thing that made them somewhat beloved.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. On YouTube, these stars are in charge of everything. They're the writers, they're the directors, they're the producers, they're the ones calling the shots. They're entrepreneurs who really build their own brand this way without necessarily help from other places. And so when you move them over to traditional media in some ways, you're asking them to be a vessel for maybe a script that's already been written or somebody else's vision. And that translation doesn't always work. And again, that authenticity piece that's so appealing to their audience can be lost if they're not careful.
So how does a studio deal with that issue of inauthenticity, I guess?
Well, I think one strategy we're seeing is that studios are giving more creative control over to these YouTube creators themselves. They're letting them have more say in the process than maybe a traditional actor or actress might have. Freddie Wong is an interesting example. I spoke to him back in July when he was making the move from YouTube to Hulu. He said he wasn't that worried about it because he and his team still were in control.
At the end of the day, we still make the things that we make. And we found that like the best strategy in this very fluid marketplace is not to be tied in to any given platform, but to be able to make good content. And good content will be able to live almost anywhere.
And I think that's the hope, is that you let these stars be who they are. They be the people that their audience has come to love, and the audience maybe will follow them there. But if you try to reshape them or put words into their mouth that aren't necessarily their words, their audience might be turned off. But again, it's all a work in progress. People are trying to figure out how to really tap into this stardom.
Marketplace's Adrienne Hill, our entertainment correspondent. Thank you.
Thanks, Lizzie.
And that's our show for this week. Next week, let's talk about the things you waste and how much that costs you. Visit Marketplace.org, chat with us on Marketplace's Facebook page, or call 1-800-648-5114. Your voice might be featured on the air. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Raghu Manavalan, Eliza Mills, and Haley Hirschman. Haley is moving on to a new Marketplace special project, and we'll miss her very much. We appreciate great contributions to the show and look forward to hearing her work in the coming months. Dan Samatovich is our senior producer. Charlton Thorpe is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao.
Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.